We're now in our seventh month of experiencing the effects of COVID-19. With no real end in sight, it's no secret that many people are feeling the mental, physical, and emotional stress of social distancing, wearing masks, limited interactions with others, and lack of consistency in state and federal approaches. And while the recent successes in some states and progress in developing a vaccine are reasons for optimism, the road to recovery has many challenges yet to come. What do we do in the meantime? The recent AARP article, Happiness in Hard Times, has some answers. By Sari Harar. Research shows that joy is wired into our genes, brain circuits, and biology, an integral part of our health equation, and in moments like these, it matters more than ever. On the short list of songs that have brought the world joy, you'd be hard-pressed to top the Beatles' Here Comes the Sun, with its lilting melody and deeply hopeful lyrics, the smiles returning to the faces. I feel the ice is slowly melting. No wonder that hospitals played it repeatedly over their public address systems this spring as an auditory bomb in some of the most stress-filled, soul-scorching places on the planet. The intensive care units overflowing with COVID-19 patients struggling to stay alive. At Lenox Hill Hospital in New York City, the song started up every time a coronavirus patient was discharged or recovered enough to breathe without the help of a ventilator. Everyone in the hospital is under tremendous pressure, says pulmonologist Stephen Feinsilver, MD, who has been caring for non-COVID-19 lung cases to free his colleagues to treat those with coronavirus. Especially for those I see on the front lines of critical care, it's like a war zone here. The work is relentless. To hear this song on the loudspeaker is brilliant. It's just what people need, a reminder that patients are recovering. You feel good for a moment. Feeling good may be the last thing on your mind as the coronavirus pandemic grinds into its seventh month in America, as we struggle to revive our arguably one of the world's worst health and economic calamities. Is even talking about happiness self-absorbed or inappropriate? Quite the contrary, countless researchers say. Pursuing happiness, and more importantly, finding it matters more during dark times, says Laurie Santos, a professor of psychology at Yale University. Happiness gives us the resilience to get through. This is a challenging time because it's both physical and mental health crisis. We need to focus on happiness more now, not less. The emotional lift provided by that Beatles song shouldn't be underestimated, notes Lenox Hill nurse manager Amanda Griffiths. The song played some 20 times on a single day, Griffiths recalls, and each repetition made her feel better. It was an overwhelming sense of, wow, we're making a difference. I got very teary-eyed. Clearly, the kind of happiness that matters in tough times has nothing to do with birthday hats or smiley faces. This isn't a delusional Hollywood glee and delight, says psychologist Maria Soroy, author of A Short Course in Happiness After Loss. The happiness that helps in great difficulty is realistic. It recognizes fear and anxieties. It looks for meaning. It nourishes and sustains us. To better understand happiness and its role in hard times, AARP asked me to speak with the full spectrum of researchers and doctors focused on the topic to find out the deeper truths of joy. Here is what they want you to know. Lesson number one, happiness is possible in dark hours. In the wake of a life-shattering crisis or global disaster, something surprisingly positive often happens. 2 months after the World Trade Center terrorist attacks in 2001, a University of Pennsylvania survey of over 4,000 Americans found that they felt more gratitude, hope, kindness, and love than they did before 9/11. And the effect wasn't transitory. In a 3-year State University of New York at Buffalo study of 1,382 American adults, 58% said they continued to see positive consequences emerge from the attacks. They weren't hiding their heads in the sand or pretending that the disaster hadn't happened. A study by psychology professor Barbara Fredrickson, now at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, found that students acknowledged the great despair, anger, and fear they felt after 9/11, but some also were buoyed by what Fredrickson calls the ordinary magic of fleeting positive emotions, such as those sparked recently in hospital patients hearing, "Here comes the sun." Finding positive meaning may be the most powerful leverage point for cultivating positive emotions during times of crisis, Fredrickson noted in the study. It's intuitive that happiness helps create and sustain emotional resilience. But the converse is true too. Emotional resilience, knowing how you can get through a crisis with a little less despair and a little more sanity and perspective, can also lead to happiness. Medical studies confirm it. They found that people dealing with a serious health crisis, like a cancer, spinal cord injury, or debilitating chronic pain, who found a higher sense of meaning in their plight, also experienced better emotional well-being. How? By switching from nursing their personal sense of tragedy to encouraging empathy with others who might have it worse. That's why so many volunteers feel deep joy in what they're doing. Suffering is never good, of course, and right now, more than 1/3 of Americans say this pandemic is having a serious impact on their mental health. According to a national poll by the American Psychiatric Association, this may not be the time to focus on fun and laughs, but something deeper can help. Psychologist Maria Soroy, who has written about the emotional resilience of children with cancer and their families, calls it positivity, a mix of realism, hope, and compassion. Holocaust survivor and psychiatrist Viktor Frankl famously called it tragic optimism. The good news is we can all reach for it. After crisis, it's estimated that up to 2/3 of adults actually experience an increase in well-being that the American Psychological Association calls post-traumatic growth. Getting to these constructive emotional states begins with acknowledging the bad, Soroy says. I could binge-watch Netflix for 7 hours a day, but that won't sustain me spiritually or emotionally or in my relationships, she says. Let yourself feel what you're really feeling. Then think about what's really important to you right now. What's in line with your values? That could be more kindness, spirituality, appreciating life in all its big and small moments, using your own strengths more in the world. Soroy says, finally, act on these goals. Go slow, take small steps. When you pay attention to how you shape your life right now, you won't feel victimized by what's going on, she says. Resilient people know they have this choice. Happiness doesn't come from outside. Lesson number 2, give up wrong ideas about happiness. Lori Santos knows a lot about unhappy people. Witnessing the stress and joylessness of her students at Yale, the psychology professor developed a course in 2018 titled Psychology and the Good Life that revealed the physical and emotional underpinnings of happiness and what could be done to increase them. The course became an instant campus phenomenon and then a worldwide sensation. Nearly 1 million people of all ages signed up for a free online version in the first 3 months of this year. The 10-session online class romps through all of the science-backed strategies for happiness you've probably heard about, like eating well, sleeping well, exercising, and managing stress. But Santos also makes a big point of dispelling misconceptions that block true well-being. Turns out, we're terrible at predicting what will actually make us happy, so we go after the wrong things, money, status, and overlook the unique everyday stuff that truly jazzes us. To start, we compare ourselves with others rather than pursuing our own bliss. Comparing yourself to other people is a great way to feel less happy, Santos says. Case in point, in studies of Olympic medalists, bronze medalists looked genuinely happier with their third place win than silver medalists. It's easy to beat yourself up because you didn't get the gold medal, Santos says, and forget about the amazing experience you're having. We also get used to the good stuff in our lives that we forget to immerse ourselves in it, and we undervalue the simple stuff because it just seems so, well, simple. Bottom line, our minds suck at happiness, Santos says. They're naturally wired for survival. We pay more attention to trouble. You have to work at happiness. Three strategies from her course and from other experts have been proven to increase happiness. First, connect. Human connection is the classic recipe, the chicken soup for happiness, underscored by some of the most credible experts in the field. Among them is Robert Waldinger, MD, director of the 83-year-old Harvard Study of Adult Development, considered the world's longest-running study of well-being. The clearer message we get from our study is this: good relationships keep us happier and healthier. Period, he says. A sense of joy seems to reach into our cells, reducing corrosive forces like inflammation and stress that break down multiple body systems over time, like your joints, your cardiovascular system, your brain, Waldinger notes. Another key finding? It's not the number of friends you have or whether you're in a committed relationship. It's the quality of your relationships that matters, Waldinger says. That's something we can work on at any age. Next, move and breathe. Physical activity can boost your happiness by reducing stress and releasing feel-good brain chemicals. Yoga is a good choice. The combination of simple postures with deep breathing can make you feel happier, said Amy Weintraub, an instructor and author for Yoga for Depression. It brings more oxygen to your brain, stimulates your vagus nerve, which calms the anxious mind, and over time can create beneficial brain changes too. And take a moment to savor. Pausing to soak in a wonderful moment, a sunrise, the morning's bird song, the joy of our pets is a great way to learn how to savor. Or you can recall a cherished memory, play music linked to a special moment, or linger over some old photos. A regular savoring habit can increase happiness for longer periods of time, said Jennifer Smith, director of research at Mather Institute in Evanston, Illinois. Third lesson, work with your happiness biology. Here's some optimistic news. As we move through our later years, the typical person grows steadily happier. There really is a U-curve of happiness, says Dartmouth College economist David Blanchflower, who published two headline-grabbing papers on the subject in January. Put simply, people in general hit high levels of happiness in their early 20s, low levels in middle age, around 47, Blanchflower says, and then start seeing a steady increase in joy from that point on. We're not talking about a cultural quirk of Americans. The study involved people from 132 countries. The U-curve occurred in places where wages are high and where they're low, in countries at the top and the bottom of life expectancy, he said. What explains this curve? Maybe it's genes, Blanchflower said. Maybe it's coming to terms with our limitations. Whatever the reason, it's ingrained in us. Frank Inferna, an Arizona State University psychologist, has his own theory. He has just finished studying 360 midlife women and men and was struck by how much more stress they were under than he ever realized. We found that midlife has become a time of crisis, Inferna says, but it's not the kind of crisis that exists in popular imagination, the foolhardy quest to regain the glory days of youth. The midlife crisis experienced by most people is subtler, more nuanced. It's a big squeeze in which adults face tough choices about how to split their resources, time, emotions, money, skills, between themselves, work, kids, and aging parents. But there's an upside to these challenges. Decades of life experience combined with brain rewiring to create a new kind of happiness for people in their 50s and beyond, said Dilip Jeste, MD and neuroscientist at the University of California, San Diego. These later life brain changes are as significant as the circulatory upgrades that turn teenagers into adults, or that promote good parenting after a first baby. In older people who keep themselves physically, mentally, and socially active, we see the growth of what we call the neurobiology of wisdom, Jeste says. You don't get as upset when things go wrong. You focus on the positive and on people and connections. You feel great when you have a sense of purpose. In her Emotion and Cognition lab at the University of Southern California, neuroscientist Mara Mather finds signs of these changes deep in the human brain. She's tracing how the brain reacts to information at different ages. Among her findings, older people remember and pay attention to positive images, cute babies, happy couples, joyous families, better than negative images. They also remember more positive experiences from their past. Meanwhile, happiness is turning up in our DNA too. Mikey Bartels is a leading expert on the genetics of joy. Since 2016, the research professor and her team at Rijksmonumentaal University in Amsterdam have discovered 304 happy genes. She suspects that more than 1,000 genes may be related to emotional well-being. We've found that 35% to 40% of the difference between people's happiness levels is genetic, she says. Bartels believes we have to respect the unique things that make each of us happy. They're wired in us. Some people get a real mood lift from exercise, but others don't. Spending time in nature may increase your happiness, but not someone else's, she says. People's likes, dislikes, and preferences are a deep part of who we are, part of our own DNA. Few people know how Here Comes the Sun came about, but the story captures what Bartels and others have been saying. The song was composed when all seemed to be going wrong within the Beatles. George Harrison just couldn't face yet another stress-filled business meeting with bandmates and accountants, so he played hooky instead and went to the house of his friend Eric Clapton. There, he borrowed a guitar and came up with the melody, Walking Around a Garden. At recording time, John Lennon was recovering from a car crash, so he never contributed to the song. The day of the song's mixing was the last time the four Beatles were ever together in a recording studio. From such tension was born one of the happiest songs in our lives. Sari Harar has written on health and science for more than 25 years, including authoring or co-authoring 17 books and contributing to about 20 national magazines. And this is Happiness RX, Play Some Music. In mid-March, when stay-at-home orders were starting to take root, two kids in Columbus, Ohio came up with a simple way to help a neighbor through the isolation. Taryn Tien, 9, and sister Calliope, 6, carried their cellos to the front porch of Helena Schlamm and played an impromptu concert for the 78-year-old Mozart fan. It was delightful, Schlamm says. Music is a comfort to me. Indeed, in difficult times, music can help relieve our mental anguish. It's almost like an aspirin. You have a back pain, Gives you a little relief, says Andy Tubman, chief of therapeutics for Musical Health Technologies, whose SingFit products guide people with dementia through singing exercises. Music can be a healthy distraction in that sense. AARP and the Global Council on Brain Health, GCBH, plan to release a report on World Music Day on how music affects the brain. People who study the brain have shown that listening to music you can enjoy can cause a release of dopamine, a chemical that increases feelings of happiness, said Sarah Lenz Locke, AARP Senior Vice President of Policy and Brain Health at GCBH Executive Director. Songs of empowerment also bubble up in troubled times. During the pandemic, songwriter Nick Lowe, 71, performed his anthem, What's So Funny About? Peace, Love, and Understanding, among other tunes, in virtual shows from his home. It's a brand new experience to me to sing into a phone, he said. But when people see a musician sitting at home and not freaking out, I suppose that cheers people up. To help, AARP has compiled a list of songs of hope and happiness. You can listen to it on streaming service Spotify, j.mp/AARP Spotify. And here are some of the selections. Beautiful Day by U2. Don't Stop by Fleetwood Mac. The River of Dreams by Billy Joel. And Louis Armstrong's What a Wonderful World. Don't Stop Believin' by Journey, Coming Out of the Dark by Gloria Estefan, Walking on Sunshine by Katrina and the Waves, and Bob Marley and the Wailers' Three Little Birds, Happy by Pharrell, Bridge Over Troubled Water, Simon and Garfunkel, and Here Comes the Sun by the Beatles, Don't Worry Baby by the Beach Boys, and Somewhere Out There by Linda Ronstadt and James Ingram. Let's Work Together by Canned Heat, and from Bob Dylan, Shelter from the Storm. What the World Needs Now is Love by Dionne Warwick, Lovely Day by Bill Withers, Mr. Blue Sky by Electric Light Orchestra, I Saw the Light by Hank Williams, and I Will Survive by Gloria Gaynor. How could anyone not feel a warming of the heart when you hear of Louis Armstrong and What a Wonderful World? As it happens, the most recent article of Reminisce magazine has an anecdote about Louis Armstrong. Don Charles of Suwanee, Georgia. Jazz diplomacy. Louis Armstrong spread the message of music. When I was 16, I met one of my musical heroes, Louis Armstrong, one of the all-time greats of jazz. The occasion was a concert given by Louis Armstrong and his All-Stars on November 24, 1956, at Muhlenberg College in Allentown, Pennsylvania. A junior at nearby Whitehall High School, I was sports editor of the school newspaper. Our faculty advisor knew I was into jazz and suggested that I interview Armstrong. My dad was active in many civic associations and knew the sponsors of the concert, so I was granted access to the band's dressing room. My favorite of Armstrong's albums was one he made a year earlier, called Ambassador Satch. It was recorded in 1955 in Europe while Armstrong and his band were touring as cultural diplomats for the U.S. Department of State. Showing how long he'd been making records, one of the songs on the album was a revival of the West End Blues, which he first recorded to great acclaim in 1928. I started my interview by saying, Mr. Armstrong, I want to tell you that I am collecting your records and I've been a fan of yours for a long time. He gave me a big smile and said simply, Thank you, Daddy. He talked about his early career and also how he hoped to play in Russia. Unfortunately, that tour never materialized. He said he never took vacations and just wanted to make music. Meanwhile, my dad spotted a professional photographer he knew and talked him into taking a picture of me with Armstrong. My interview and the picture ran on the front page of the school newspaper. So on that issue of Reminisce is a short piece on Annette Funicello. It contains a quote of hers, "I'm not putting on any airs. I'm not trying to fool anybody. I'm a happy person." Well, when Annette Funicello put on mouse ears for the new Disney variety show Mickey Mouse Club, she quickly became the favorite of the ensemble. She got her own spin-off series, Annette, in 1958, taking the first steps toward a recording career with the hit How Will I Know My Love. She traded ears for a bikini in several beach party musicals with Frankie Avalon, achieving peak fame as a teen queen. Through it all, Funicello maintained a sterling reputation as the modest girl next door. Walt spotted her at the ballet. Funicello was born into a blue-collar Italian-American family in Utica, New York, and grew up in Los Angeles. In 1955, Walt Disney scouted the 12-year-old in a ballet performance, and she got the last of 24 spots on Disney's new TV show. Fans fell immediately in love with the friendly Mouseketeer with the curly black hair. Everyone wanted to be her friend or boyfriend. Judging by the letters, thousands she got each week, fans couldn't get enough, making films that included Babes in Toyland in 1961. She wore a large demure bikini. In the 1960s, she got the go-ahead from Disney to star in teen beach movies, provided they preserve Funicello's clean image. She and co-star Frankie Avalon, who played her boyfriend, surfed, swam, and squabbled in this wholesome series with musical up-and-comers and paper-thin plots. Making recordings was a logical step. Though she joked that she had only a 3-note range, Funicello's songs found an audience. Tall Paul in 1959 and O Dio Mio in 1960 were both top 10 hits. She recorded several albums with plays on her name like Italianette and Hawaiianette. Her organization helped others. Diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1987, Funicello kept her condition private for several years. In 1999, she established a nonprofit foundation, still active today, to research MS and other neurological disorders. I am one that finds great joy in listening to music, especially classical music. What could bring me greater joy than hearing Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, an Ode to Joy, on my way to my favorite farm market to buy peaches, a favorite fruit? I leave you with a suggestion to hum a few notes or words of something that brings a smile to your face. Thanks for listening, and until next week, I'm Kathy Van Squyke.